Odds are you've heard of the brands Poo-Pourri and Squatty Potty, and odds are you've seen one of the hysterical commercials on YouTube. Commercials that have gone viral. Commercials that, when you include all of the clients from the team that made these videos, have had over 1.4 billion views. While at Social Media Marketing World in San Diego, I had the opportunity to sit down with Dan Harmon of the Harmon Brothers and get inside his head. What makes someone so amazingly creative? Let's find out. Buckle up, because here we go.
Please keep clear of the doors. You are delaying the departure of this train.
Singing podcast, right?
Yeah, what you were gonna sing? You've lost that loving feeling, right?
You've lost that loving feeling. I can't
you that. Could actually pass for an Everly Brother.
Everly Brother?
Yeah, that's who.
Oh no,
is, I'm
is
sorry.
The band? No, it's the Righteous,
Righteous Brothers.
Brothers. Yeah,
that was unrighteous of me to miss, quantify, qualify, misnomer the good. Great band. Well, we're in San Diego, and you just asked me where. To eat.
Yes, I did.
And I mentioned the Casey barbecue.
Yeah, you said the barbecue's good there. I haven't tried it yet. It sounds fantastic.
But that's where they filmed Top Gun. That's what it's really known for.
Yeah.
So you could see like the bar where he got down on his knees and started singing the Righteous Brothers.
Yeah. Very cool.
And you'll feel very touristy.
Yes. That's what anybody wants when coming to a spot like this.
And full of barbecue.
I want to feel touristy.
And full of barbecue.
Yeah.
What a great tagline on your website. Get a crap ton of eyeballs with ads that brand and sell.
We figure it's memorable.
It's super memorable. It's straight to the point, and your stuff is just funny.
Well, thank you.
I just so...
Mostly
I was,
not because of me.
Well, that's not entirely somebody true. Had to have the idea that this is how we're going to sell stuff to people on YouTube.
Yeah, so a lot of that idea originally came from my brother. So my brother Jeffrey was basically hired as the marketing department for a company called Aurabrush. And that is where he pulled together a bunch of college roommates, made a video, kind of being inspired by some of the vloggers and such of the time, pulled in a roommate to help him write on it and stuff. And then it was kind of the first use case of being able to use an ad in order to drive a positive ROI on YouTube. Mm-hmm. And they got to a point where they knew they could predictably spend a dollar behind that Aurabrush ad, the tongue cleaner for bad breath, and they could get, you know, $2 back or $3 or whatever it was at the time, and invested it right back into the business.
Just, yeah, you're printing money.
Yep, it was became a money printing machine, and that was the kind of catalyst that eventually catapulted Aurabrush into Walmart, mm-hmm. into CVS, and Walgreens. And
what was the ad?
It's called How to Tell If You Have Bad Breath. I think that's the title. I
was it funny or was it?
It had some funny parts, yeah. For sure. It wasn't as funny as our stuff now.
You're dealing with halitosis.
Yeah, you're dealing with halitosis, which is a made-up word, by the way. By Listerine.
Really?
Yes. And a brilliant marketing campaign by Listerine in the early 1900s. They made up this term.
It's not a medical term.
It is now, but they brought it into the vernacular. And we were able to use it in the ad as well as
a what did doctors call bad breath before that term was coined? A foul odor from thy mouth?
I don't know. Like technically, it's kind of a weird word because if you have like, well, let's see. So halitosis. I think it was. Are you going to Google it right now?
I'm going to look it up right now. I want to know.
Well, now
the origin.
I'm getting worried that I might be wrong.
Well, but you know, it could just be urban legend.
It could be. But I think I think if you look up the history of the word halitosis.
Yeah. So I'm looking it up here on the all-knowing Wikipedia. You know, bad breath is halitosis. There's no. You know that they're definitely calling it what it is.
Yes.
I am looking, we get signs and symptoms, talk about oral hygiene in the mouth. And there's a picture here of the normal appearance of the tongue.
Yes.
That shows a degree of visible white coating and normal irregular surfaces on the posterior dorsum. Did they make up those terms also? What are we going to call that?
Someone makes up everything, right?
That's true. On the posterior dorsum. You know, if you said to somebody, I like your posterior dorsum, they wouldn't think they were talking about your tongue.
You were, it sounded like you were coming up with a really bad pickup line.
Somebody out there is going to have to look this up because this page on halitosis goes on and on and on. You know what? I like to believe we like to believe things that aren't true. Right?
Okay, so believe this one and it'll make it true.
I'm believing this one.
Okay. So anyway, did you want me to continue with the story? Are we going to stay on Wikipedia for a bit?
I have given up on Wikipedia.
Okay.
Right. We're going to go with that is true.
Okay. So
we've just fact check it with our crack team of gophers.
Okay. Yes. If your people can get after that, that'd be fantastic because I'd love to validate it myself. So ultimately, the success of Aura Brush and the tongue cleaner and everything that went along with it led to my brother getting discovered on LinkedIn by the owner of Poopery. And then she was like, okay, you're the guy I need to do.
So that was the real visionary there, right? The owner of Poopery connected with what they saw your brother do.
Yep. Yep.
And, I mean, they're you owe them pretty much.
Oh, everything. Yeah. I mean, for sure. Like, it is, I wouldn't say everything, but yes, they're for sure. It was like a great partnership of a fantastic product.
Most things.
Uh-huh.
A few things.
A couple things. A lot of things.
You owe them $1.50.
But it was a great partnership of a fantastic product, and they sent us product to sample, and we loved it and everything, and so we resigned from Aura Brush at the time where we were all working. So it was three of us brothers that were working at Aura Brush, and we were kind of all heading up the marketing side of things there. And then we left to go do the Poopery campaign.
All three of you?
All three of us, yeah.
So who's your other brother?
So Jeffrey and then Neil. Neil was actually over operations at Aura Brush. And we thought we were going to be the marketing department of Poopery as well, just like we had been for Aura Brush, and that Neil was going to run operations. We thought that's what we thought we were getting ourselves into. And it didn't turn out to make sense business-wise for us, but the campaign took off, and it was...
You make funny video, that's what they said, right?
Well, ultimately what happened is when we launched it, we were literally launching it from my brother's kitchen table in Utah, and the press started to come out, and the Huffington Post picked it up, and Adweek and Ad Age and all these. They started citing creative agency Harmon Brothers. And Harmon Brothers was just a name that was given to the legal entity for the campaign money.
You didn't know that was going to be your agency.
Oh, no. No, like, that was the farthest thing from our minds. At least those of us there at that time, that was the case. And then we were looking across the kitchen table at each other and being like, I guess we're an agency. Are we an agency? I mean,
they're calling us an agency.
We did some work for hire for a particular brand, and it's an ad campaign. Yeah, we're an agency, and that's where the name stuck. And we definitely would not have chosen that as the name of an agency, but I guess it works. Whatever. And then from there, that is, obviously, Poopery went crazy viral. Right. It was early days of YouTube as well.
Let's talk about that for a moment. The feeling, the moment you saw this thing blow up.
Yeah.
Right? It's like your first big hurrah.
Yeah.
When did you know? You know, what were the numbers that made you go, oh, man, this is a thing?
Yeah. So one of the first numbers was 1 million views in under a week.
Yeah.
And that was including some of the early stage testing that we'd been doing. We'd been doing a lot of non-public testing with things like thumbnails for the video and titles and all that kind of stuff. The winning title, Girls Don't Poop, actually came from a YouTube commenter.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah.
Did they get credit for it? Did they get some free potpourri or something?
Well, and the fact that we've acknowledged that we've acknowledged over and over again. I can't even remember the name of the commenter, but it was just someone that just randomly was like, whatever, girls don't poop. You know, yeah. They put something like that on a YouTube comment. We're like, oh, we should test that. And it like it outpaced the nearest title by, I forget what the percentage was. It was like 37% better, something along those lines of any other title that we had running at the time. We do very thorough testing. And ultimately, that was the one that we went public with. It was the one that got picked up by Huffington Post. And by the time it was getting placed within other content on people's blogs and in news articles and stuff, then it was like, okay, the cat was out of the bag. We let it out in the wild and made it public and then just started pushing dollars behind it, sold them out of product. They were not ready in the least for the amount of demand that was going to be generated. Neither were we.
How much product are we talking about?
I don't even remember what it was at the time, but like almost every company that comes to us and works with us reinsures us. Oh yeah, we've got it taken care of.
Right.
And this has been a little bit of a theme that we've had where we've like run people right to the brink on some product, and it hasn't happened every time, but that was definitely one of the times when it did. And then ultimately, like I said, we were all over the news. The name had stuck, and that was ultimately what got us noticed by Bobby Edwards, who was the CEO and founder of Squatty Potty.
Okay.
And he said he was very mad when he saw the Poopery video because he was like, that should have been my brand. And so he reached out to Jeffrey as well and said, I want you to do this for me, and sent him a Squatty Potty and all the rest.
But I want a unicorn and I want ice cream. And
those were his very words. I will only do this if I can do a unicorn and some ice cream.
Yeah.
No, he was like, I don't know how you're going to do it, but I would love for you guys to find a way to make this taboo subject of the colon, pooping posture and pooping health, an okay thing to talk about. And because that's essentially what we had done with Poopery, right? Yeah. The stink of the bathroom was now an okay subject for people to talk about. Like, oh, you'd never hear people be like, oh yeah, I have some like poopery. Yeah. Like they say that like with pride now, right? Or, I've got a Squatty Potty, and they're talking about their bathroom.
You're talking to the iFart guy here, so no shame.
That's right.
I speak poop.
Yeah.
That's, you know, native tongue for me.
But a lot of the way that we create content is with the intent of creating dinner table type conversations and water cooler conversations, that stuff that will stick with people and that makes the kind of impact, emotional impact, that they'll then talk to other people about it openly.
Right, which is the essence of viral. Tell a story so compelling that others will retell it for you, right?
Yes.
So let's break down the Squatty Potty commercial. For those who haven't seen it, they're just, you know, they've been in cryo freeze and they're just waking up.
There are
up
still
now.
Some out there.
In 2020, sum up the commercial.
In 2020, the commercial is a pooping unicorn that poops rainbow soft serve ice cream as a way to demonstrate the function of the human body, in that when you are squatting, it is a healthy elimination position, because you have a little muscle that actually puts a kink in your colon when you are in a sitting position as opposed to a squatting position, and you eliminate more freely. And so this was a unicorn literally pooping ice cream, and there's a prince that's the spokesperson and that's taking the ice cream and licking it and doing all that and talking about how the Squatty Potty is just the best, and doing it with a lovely British accent so that it feels more palatable to say a lot of poop jokes.
Right.
And yeah, it has, I think, to date over 300 million views across all versions of it on Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, and whatnot. And they were on a $7 million run rate when they approached us, or at least that was their goal or something along those lines. And then they jumped up to over 20 million the next year, and it was just a huge thing. It was a bigger spike for them than Shark Tank, which Shark Tank had been huge. And that's essentially what had happened. So they'd had so much success getting their product on Shark Tank, and there was such a sales spike, but then it wasn't sustainable. It wasn't sustainable over time. It didn't keep their sales really up. It didn't establish a much higher baseline.
Right.
It was a burst and then over. Yeah. And they were looking for something more sustainable, and the unicorn campaign became that for them. We were able to follow it up with another unicorn video that we did something like 50 million views on, and then there was another one that was another like 40 or 50 million views.
I don't know that I've seen the other ones.
Yeah, they're worth checking out. There's one with a pooping dragon.
Oh, and who doesn't want a pooping dragon?
And it poops gold bricks.
Perfect. So I want to get inside the mind, the creative process for this. The brothers and the rest of your team, you get together and you're like, okay, we got Squatty Potty. They want a killer ad from us. Here's the goal. Where do you start?
So the goal, again, was to make it something that's really gross, the colon, safe to talk about. And so Jeffrey started with, what is something that's like poop but isn't gross? And so that's where soft serve ice cream came into play.
That come pretty quickly. Like,
I don't know how long it took him. I just remember him coming into work one day and saying, hey, so what do you think about the idea of like a soft serve ice cream as a metaphor for poop? I was like, I think it might be brilliant. I don't know if that was my exact words, but I was like, yeah, I think this could work. And then we were like, well, ice cream comes in all sorts of different flavors, many of which look like something that probably belongs in a toilet. And so we wanted to stay away from all that. And that's where we're like, okay, we're going to have to make this into a really kind of fantastic rainbow color.
No rocky road.
No rocky road. No chocolate anything.
Yeah.
No pistachio. No banana. I don't know if banana is an ice cream flavor. But ultimately, that's kind of where we are molding. Like, okay, if we're going to do ice cream, what is it coming out of? And we are tossing this idea back and forth. And like, is it some sort of a soft serve machine in the shape of a man? Is it, what is this thing? And ultimately, we just decided, okay, it's got to be a unicorn. I can't remember who came up with that.
What else would poop a rainbow?
Yeah, if something's going to poop ice cream, it's got to be a unicorn. Yeah. And because I mean, online there was even like recipes for unicorn poop cookies.
Okay,
and so we were like, okay,
I think I've had one of those.
Yeah. So ultimately, that's where we landed, was like, okay, it's got to be unicorn. And then in the writing retreat process with the client, we brought in a experienced sketch comedian writer, Dave Vance, and he brought the concept home with the idea of putting it in a fantasy world with a prince, a really posh prince that was like, as he put it, a prince with a silver spoon up his butt is what he said.
Also British.
also
there's
British.
Something about British that makes everything more palatable.
And then just he talking it with every bit of that confidence, mm-hmm, of like, I'm saying the worst thing in the world, but I have no, like, it doesn't even faze me that I'm saying this.
There's
is the way
no
I talk
shame
every day.
There's
no
all.
Shame at all. And that is what made it come together for the client. Because ultimately, originally what had happened is Bobby, the CEO of Squatty Potty, when he came to us and we gave him the idea, he took it to his parents, who were co-founders, and he took it to one of his very influential investors, and they just didn't get it. They didn't like it. A pooping unicorn, what? And then he went and hired another production or marketing company of some kind, got terrible results out of it, came back to us 3 months later and said, I think I was wrong. I think, yeah, you guys are the right ones to do this. I don't know what you're going to do with it, but I'm just going to trust you. You did poopery. You did Aura Brush. You're going to make this happen. And then it came together for them when they heard the first read with the prince and
that
the
was
unicorn.
It.
And then we had to, you know, make little adjustments, like the prince, the unicorn wasn't going to be a big full-size unicorn. It needed to be a small pet-sized kind of more dog-like little cutesy, mm-hmm, stuffed animal-ish unicorn. And that he needed to be pooping onto a conveyor belt with the ice creams coming through almost like on a production line. And a lot of the time you spent pooping in the toilet and all that, all those kind of decisions come, you know, as you just kind of muddle through this process.
Do you guys have a big whiteboard in the office where you're just writing down every ridiculous idea you can think of?
You know, we don't. We should. We've actually thrown that idea around a lot and then never made it into a whiteboard. But we have different writers that we go to. And ultimately, that's where we get really different thinking. So we'll go and get, on any given client now, when we get together with them for the writing retreat, we have three or four different writers coming with different perspectives and different concepts. and they're working individually from each other, so they're not like poisoning the well. They're all working off of the same. They know what message they have to hit. They know the objectives they have to go for, but then they'll come to it with different ways to solve for that and different creative ideas. And then we hone in on the one that we feel like is the best backbone for that script, which is the same thing that we did with Squatty Potty, where it was like, okay, the prince with the unicorn, that's the world we're going to live in. Now, I've got some good jokes over here from mine. I've got some good sales copy over here from yours. Let's piece this thing together and let's make it, let's use the best of all our writing and mix that together. And that's a little bit of our process, is to kind of Frankenstein things together in that actual scripting process. You kind of have to check your ego at the door a little bit.
Right.
Can't be like, oh, that mind's got to win kind of a thing. That the ultimately, the client needs to be bought in, and then the creative director needs to be bought in, because they're going to be the one charging this thing forward for the next, you know, 4 or 5 months or whatever to see it through to the end. And that's our process that we go through.
And you've got to be laughing like crazy, right?
You're tossing
all these ideas around and just the spontaneous comedy. It's really improv when you're throwing out ideas.
It is very much so. And the first day when the first reads happen, that is like one of the most magical times, where the client's like, oh yeah, we're totally getting our money worth, you know, where they're just like over the moon at like all this creativity and all this comedy coming into stuff. It is really a fun time at those writing retreats, hearing those ideas. And it is, the difficulty comes more in as you write and refine, jokes become less funny when you hear them for the third and the fourth and the fifth time.
Well, that's how you can do a sitcom in front of a live studio audience without cracking up, right?
That's right. That's right. And ultimately, that's kind of the big challenge, is you go through it. It's remembering your first reaction to it is kind of key. Mm-hmm. And so that's...
And then you start... Then when you take it to film, and you in the artwork that goes with it, the animations, and you see that come to life with all the bright colors and the hilarity, the facial expressions.
Yeah.
The first time you saw the final cut of it, right? You're like, this is it.
Uh-huh.
What is that? What did that feel like?
It didn't feel like that.
Probably because you had so many cuts before.
I had been, you know, we'd been doing late nights and overnighters and that kind of stuff, just getting it out the door.
Really ship the damn thing.
I know. It was very much along the lines of, the deadline's here. It's got to go out.
Yeah.
This is the form that it's going out in. And I can still go back and point out flaws, right? And I can in almost any of our ads. I shouldn't say almost any of our ads. Any of the ones that I've worked as a creative director on or directed on, I can point out all the little things that I wish I could have done. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, we don't finish. It's the same thing as like Pixar, where they say they don't ever finish their films. They just release them. And it's the same thing with our ads. We don't ever feel like we really finish them. But there is a release date that comes, and you just got to ship it at some point. And obviously, we feel like it's very refined. It's very good. We're kind of perfectionists.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Does anybody compare you to Don Draper?
It has been done in the past. Not as much me. My brother Jeffrey got compared to Don Draper back in the day.
I want to know what life in the Harmon household was like when you guys were teenagers. Like, what's the age breakdown of you boys?
Oh, the age breakdown, like of us now?
Who's the oldest?
So the oldest is Theron, and he is involved in the business on the client relations side.
And how many years to the next?
And then there's Michelle, and then there's Neil, who I mentioned earlier, who was running operations at Aura Brush, and he's also a founder of Harmon Brothers. Then there's myself and Jeffrey, and then it moves on down to Jenny and Dallin and Jordan and Kaylisha.
Your typical Utah family.
Well,
right?
Idaho.
Idaho.
Yeah.
Close. Same genre.
I wouldn't say nine is very typical.
It is a lot of kids. But the three brothers that are involved in business, you're within how many years of one another?
The three of us that were there, Neil's 2 years older than me. Jeffrey's 2.5 years younger than me. So it's about all within 5 years.
So, did you know, when you guys were kids, you know, creativity, starts in childhood,
uh-huh.
right? So what kind of things were you guys messing around with, experimenting with then in the creative platforms?
Mostly experimenting with poverty.
Yeah.
No, literally it starts with that, in that we didn't really have a lot of toys or things like that given to us because my parents were very poor.
You had an imagination.
We had an imagination, and we had a lot of room to roam. We had a nice set of aspen trees mm-hmm. that literally ran, I think it's about a 2-acre lot that we were on out in, you know, rural Idaho, in the middle of all these, surrounded by potato, wheat, and beet fields, that kind of a thing. And we were allowed to go out for a lot of our time and just work on tree houses. Tom Sawyer and Swiss Family Robinson was a big inspiration for us. If I went back and watched Swiss Family Robinson now, I'd probably think it was pretty sexist, I hear. But, you know, made it at a different time for a very different, you know, style of audience at the time. But ultimately, we used a lot of that inspiration to build elaborate tree houses in these really tall trees. Mm-hmm. We'd scrap together wood from construction sites where they'd have surplus or things that they weren't using of some kind, and we'd bring that and we would make, I mean, we made rafts that we would go and put in our canal that was about a quarter mile away, and we actually had a functional raft with a mast up the middle, and we were really successful at one point when we knew we had a tarp that we attached to the mast. And we anchored it down on the bottom of the raft, and we actually got it to pull us up against the current of the canal for a little while.
Ahoy, mateys.
The Idaho wind is very strong.
Yeah.
It wasn't very, I think we were going probably 0.0001 miles an hour, but it was still, we weren't going downstream, we were going up, and we thought that was a huge achievement. Our first attempt at a raft didn't work very well until we learned to actually take some styrofoam. And because when it was all wood, we realized once we got on top of it, it wasn't enough wood to just keep us afloat. Like we thought in the movies, that's the way it is, right? But there's a lot more underneath the water than what you see. So we got styrofoam and put it underneath and then bonded it on with chicken wire and made that work. We made paper toys. Mm-hmm. That was a big thing for us because we didn't have a lot of toys. We would have paper, and we would have crayons, and we would have tape. And we would make our own
building blocks.
And we would make our own little, like, transformers.
Right.
Out of paper toys. We would make marble runs as well. And what I mean by that is we'd attach to the side of the stairway and the banister and whatever a little piece of basically a railway system,
right,
for a marble.
That way,
we would do those. So they were pretty elaborate, where they'd like jump and, mm-hmm. and do that kind of
thing.
What do
you call those machines that they make?
Like
that,
a Rube Goldberg kind of
Goldberg
machine. Yeah.
Have you seen that guy on YouTube that does those?
Probably at some point.
Those are
pretty fascinating.
He'll sit there, he's eating, and then this machine goes off and does all this crazy stuff, and then it drops dessert on his plate at the end of it.
Yeah, I think I've seen some
of
those videos.
Crazy.
Yeah.
He, that's all he does. I wish I could remember his name, but all he does is
build these machines.
Yeah, I
wish I could remember it too, but I know I've come across one of his videos or two.
So as you're creating with whatever supplies you guys have on hand, where does the storytelling come in?
So we did have enough media to be inspired by some of that. We had some classic books around that we'd read. Again, Tom Sawyer. I remember reading Little House on the Prairie as a kid. We had some, I mean, was very inspired by Star Wars. Saw that at a very, who wasn't? Yeah, that was just amazing.
How
old
were you when it came out?
I don't know how old was it. Well, I wasn't even born yet.
Okay, so see, I'm dating myself. I was there in the theater the week it came out. I was 13 years old.
No, it was a big deal when it aired, and I was probably 7 or 8, and my parents let me watch it. And I remember that first scene of them blasting through that doorway and just being like, this is the most amazing thing ever. And
it was.
Yeah, it was. It was incredible. It was extremely groundbreaking. And I remember being inspired by obviously a lot of Disney movies and playing different stories out in my head about like Indiana Jones, you know, Mission Impossible, that type of stuff. There was a lot of, I mean, we didn't we didn't watch tons of media in our house. That wasn't a huge thing. It wasn't a TV on all the time, but I got glimpses enough, and we had you know, some of the Disney animated classics and things. I remember my mom always had It's a Wonderful Life, mm-hmm. was there, which is my all-time favorite movie now, and I get, yeah. some of it is attached to nostalgia, but again, what's important to me is often more the moral fiber of the story,
right.
than even sometimes the story itself.
And every time a bell rings, an angel gets its wings. Yeah,
that is the moral fiber of the whole thing.
My all-time favorite is Shawshank Redemption.
Oh, it's a great movie.
Which is incredible storytelling. And interestingly, if I was truthful, it's tied with another film for number one.
Mm-hmm.
And totally different genre, totally different time. It's a musical, Singing in the Rain.
Oh, yeah, it's a good one. I didn't see it until I was a teenager. But I love musicals.
It's the ultimate
we had The Sound of Music. Musical. I love that one.
Yeah. Well, mm-hmm. The Hills Were Alive. How could you not love mm-hmm. them? You know? Mm-hmm. So you got some access to storytelling in your house. Not necessarily a lot, mm-hmm. but your imagination's going wild.
Yeah.
And when did you realize that this wacky sense of humor that you guys had was thing? I mean, is Monty Python inspired, or Airplane, or what?
I was always one of the funnier kids, I think, in the house. That was a little bit of my identity within the house, is that mm-hmm. I was one of
the clown.
Funny ones. But we've all had a sense of humor. We grew up in a lot of poverty and hardship, and that was just the way we got through it, was that we learned to relate with one another, and we learned to deal with some of that by just laughing at ourselves. Mm-hmm. And so my dad always had a good sense of humor. And so it would come out at weird times. You wouldn't always be able to predict it, but when it was there, like it was really good. And so we kind of developed that, I think, at an early age, just in dealing with that. And then part of the storytelling aspect literally comes in the boredom of doing menial farm labor. And what I mean by that is getting up at before 5 o'clock in the morning and going out to the potato or the barley or the wheat field and changing irrigation, mm-hmm. irrigation pipes.
Monotony.
Oh, just total monotony of like, move this, go grab this 40-foot aluminum pipe, pick it up, move it 50 feet, attach it, go get the next one, do that 32 times over. Mm-hmm. And then move on and do it again over
it's
over
good thing
again.
You had a big family, right? I mean, that's a lot of hands on deck there.
There was a lot of that hands on deck, but also like I milked cows, you know, hoeing beets, like literally milk cows by hand.
Yeah,
we had a kind of a pet cow that we used for our milk that my brother got, and he was going to be a millionaire, a dairy farmer, because he had this whole scheme, this pyramid scheme, if you will, with cows, where she was going to bear two heifers, so two female cows, mm-hmm. and then they were each going to have two heifers, and so on and so forth, and he was going to be a millionaire by age 18. This was his whole plan, and then the cow had two steers in a row, so two males, two bulls in a row, and then mm-hmm. he gave up.
He's
on
like,
that.
This is bull.
Yeah, this is double crap. Bull. What's going on? Yeah.
He wished there was another way. Oh, sorry.
But not honestly, sorry. A lot of my drive was working out in those long days in the hot sun, and like driving truck, and a lot of these things where my mind was constantly going, and I was saying to myself things like, I'm going to college. But I was also repeating a lot of storytelling in my head and putting myself into some of my favorite stories, you know, that I would somehow be like a third character or fourth character to Han and Luke and Leia. Like I would somehow be in that.
Oh, so you didn't, you inserted yourself into the story. You didn't.
Or sometimes replaced.
Right.
Both. Some of both.
But that's really interesting because usually, at least for me and the kids that, you know, I would play with, when you role played, you would take on the role of a character. To insert yourself in there is seriously egotistic. I love it. I am here. I think that's great. It demonstrates a healthy ego in a child.
Oh, okay.
Right?
Well, good.
To see yourself that alongside these people that are doing amazing things.
Yeah. And
I've not heard that before. That's really unique to you.
Well, what's really interesting about it is that I am not CEO of Harmon Brothers, right? Mm-hmm. I'm chief creative officer. And I have learned this about myself, that I'm not necessarily a perfect match for a number one. But I can be a really good complement.
A number two.
Yes, a number two. Thank you, Joel.
Perfect.
Yes, that I can be a great support and a great kind of partner mm-hmm. in that way. And that's where I thrive. And it's always been kind of that way with my brothers as well, as far as I think they just had more naturally dominant personalities mm-hmm. in that sense. And so maybe that was just my place of where I fit in with my family.
But you're also the face.
But it was very, yeah, I am.
You're the guy who goes, you know, I mean, we could say Harbin Brothers. We don't know how many there are because we just see you at the events and you're the one talking.
Yeah, I mean, there's Benton as well, our CEO, and he gets around to all the events as well. But yeah, I've been kind of the face. I mean, I still have the same last name that I had at the beginning. But yeah, it's interesting that you pick out this insight of like imagining yourself as kind of a companion to mm-hmm. Indiana Jones or to, you know, Han or Luke or whatever. Don't get me wrong. I just the same as anybody else. I've imagined myself in the actual role.
Right.
But I do remember distinctly playing out as like, well, what if they had a buddy that came along and was helping
hey,
them out?
Little buddy, I know. Let's go into space.
Yeah, that's right.
Dun, 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 dun.
That's right.
That's really, it's really unique. And you probably didn't really think about that because it's you doing it. But mm-hmm. maybe you'll be aware when you see others, you know, ask them, have you ever inserted yourself alongside?
Or I should ask that. That's a very interesting conversation.
Is it always you? It could be when you're doing a talk, you could actually ask the audience.
Yeah.
And then weave a story into that.
Yeah.
Speaking of stories, I have a hunch that you aspire to do more than tell advertising stories.
Yes, your hunch is correct. So Harbin Brothers, our why is to share better stories. For us, that has a lot of meaning. We want to share stories that make the world a better place. So we want to do it for products and services that we're really passionate about. I always say nothing sells better than the truth. And if you can really feel, if you really do sincerely feel the passion behind something, that'll come across in your work. And so we also want to share stories in a better way than we have in the past, always trying to improve. And we want to do it in a way that helps our clients do it better than they've done before. It has a lot of different meanings to us, but we don't feel like it's exclusive to advertising. We feel like there's definitely a place for us to hone our skill set in ads, but then ultimately translate it over to something like TV or film. And there's a lot of precedent for this in that Pixar did that originally. Walt Disney went down that path. Ridley Scott, Jim Henson. There's a number of other people. The director of Napoleon Dynamite, I believe, had done some commercials.
Low budget. What a hit there, right?
Yeah, but that's kind of what we feel like is we have other stories that we want to tell, and we want to get into that business of doing it. It's just kind of one step at a time, but we've got some stuff in the works that hopefully will see the light of day soon. We'll see.
I'm sure it will, because as I sit here with you, I think about what it would be like to be with a world-renowned director, right? Somebody who's produced a film or a television show that may have won awards and that everybody knows, and you're asking them the history of how they got started. And if I look into the future, I feel like I'm sitting with a guy who one day will be doing those interviews because people admire, you know, either a film or a television show work that they've done. And I'll be able to say,
I appreciate that. That's a lot of confidence.
Talent is talent. And when you know what you do well and you own that, you're unstoppable.
Oh, thanks. Well, that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to really lean into that. And I feel like there are so many principles that carry over in great storytelling and ads, in getting the clarity of your message right, in resonating emotionally with people, that also carry over into great storytelling in TV and in film. A lot of the films that I walk away from and I'm like, I didn't really like that one. It's like, I didn't clearly know where the hero was going.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know what their objective was exactly. I couldn't, like, who was the enemy? Like, if you're adding in all that confusion, so, like, sometimes that can work out really well, but usually there's a pretty good formula for making sure that your audience is able to follow along. And I feel like some of the skills that we've developed in ad making will lend themselves well to to that when we make that jump.
The worst question that you could ask yourself when you're leaving a theater is why?
Uh-huh.
Right? You can get past how because you could suspend disbelief.
Right.
What should, if you don't know the what, uh-huh. then you've totally missed the story completely. But if you walk out going, why? You're really asking, why did I spend this last, 2 hours here? I've walked away with nothing. And that's not the kind of story you want to tell.
No, I don't. I get that there's a place in the world for that. And I don't mind making people question things. That's fine. I just don't know. I don't know that. Yeah, I just don't aspire to that kind of storytelling. Very much more along the lines of Pixar mm-hmm. or a lot of what Marvel has done. Like a lot of people kind of get after Marvel, like, oh, they're formulaic and whatnot. I'm like, mm-hmm. formulas work. Formulas are formulas because they work.
Right.
And it's ultimately, if you continue to do those in a fresh and quality way, then no one really cares that you're following formula. It's when you do it to the point that it starts to feel cliche or doesn't feel well executed on, that's when people really start to care, right? And if it gets too repetitious, then you're not adding anything fresh. But it's not the formula that necessarily has to freshen up. It's the way that you're doing it.
Mm-hmm. Iron Man number 54, right? What's your favorite Pixar film? Yeah, your Desert Island Pixar. You gotta pick one.
I gotta pick one.
Let's say all the Pixar films. Here, I'm gonna make this harder. All Pixar films are gonna be wiped out in the future, except one that you can save.
This is a terrible thought.
By putting it in a time capsule, and they'll discover it, and they'll go, Dan Harmon, Academy Award-winning director, had the foresight to stash away this one Pixar film.
This is too much because
it's brutal.
I would make a different choice for society than I would for myself because mm-hmm. it's probably a different one.
Well, for you.
The ones that I resonated with the most. Oh, that is so hard. I really liked Finding Nemo, and I know that's not everybody's favorite.
Doesn't have to be.
But I when I watched it, I was just so blown away by the artistry and by... I really loved the message. Again, there was such a good message about this father learning to let go and allow his son to grow up. And also, there's not like, I guess there's Darla, but there's not like a hardcore bad guy throughout the thing. There's the moment with Darla, but I kind of appreciated the fact that so much of the adventure that happened in it didn't have to come from like a bad guy being present the whole time. And I guess maybe that is even a little bit of a theme with Pixar overall because there's a lot of just drama and conflict that happens between Woody and Buzz Lightyear. Yeah. And that doesn't have to bring in like Sid until the very... Well, Sid does come in a little
Sid
bit early
on
that
in,
one.
Sid does come in,
but
he's kind of like an ancillary bad guy.
That's right. And Pixar does a little bit of those kind of ancillary bad
situational
things.
Situational still.
Yeah. Uh-huh. But I mean, high up there for me is obviously Inside Out. Monsters is phenomenal. All the Toy Stories
out
are
yet. I guess my kids are grown and gone, which I know is a poor excuse for saying stop seeing.
You'll love Inside
children's
Out.
Movies, but yeah. I'll put that on my thing. Monsters Inc. I think is just.
I love Monsters Inc.
Amazing.
I love Toy Stories 1, 2, and 3. I really like number 4 too. It wasn't quite at the same level for me as mm-hmm. those others, but all 3 of those, I love them for their own reasons. Honestly. It'd probably be The Incredibles.
The Incredibles. Okay, why?
It'd probably rise above all of them. Same kind of thing. Nuclear family. Uh-huh. That was a really awesome theme in there.
You mean
I loved
nuclear,
it.
Right?
Nuclear, sorry.
We have presidents that have talked like that. George George Bush sorry. And George W.
That's,
Bush.
That's the Idaho in me coming out. That's the Idaho in me coming out. But ultimately, like, The Incredibles was so action-packed and so well-paced mm-hmm. and so fun, and the themes of it and everything, I thought it was awesome.
It was incredible.
Yeah, it was incredible.
They kind of built it into there like that. Mm-hmm. What about on the other side of film, maybe not family films, but just in terms of something epic that's not an adventure film, not Lord of the Rings,
okay.
not Star Wars, not Indiana
you're limiting
Jones,
me here. Okay.
But just something that you feel is incredible storytelling and rewatchable. Every time it comes on, you're like, oh, drop everything. It's on.
I don't know if it's Drop Everything and It's On, but I revisit it every year. It's a Wonderful Life is my all-time favorite movie. And I really relate with things that have a strong moral fiber, and I feel like that really does ultimately that George Bailey is willing to give up his own interests for the good of his community, I think is a really, really cool message, and that he does it voluntarily, right? And it just makes me bawl every single time.
And Lionel Barrymore is the best bad guy.
Yes. He's such a good bad guy.
Oh.
And it was one of the films that we had growing up. And so I know there's some nostalgia for me. And it's really good filmmaking when you go back and look at it. It is really good filmmaking. Very compelling performances. Like Potter, like you said, is just an amazing bad guy. His wife, I forget what her...
Mary.
Well, Mary, but I mean the actor's name, I forget. She's phenomenal, and I
youth
I just
is
love
wasted on the young.
That's right.
Still classic.
It is very classic. So that's a great one. If I was to non-adventure films, because I very much gravitate towards the.
I'm not letting you go
films.
To your easy zone on this.
Yeah, let's see. What are some other ones that really impacted me in a big way? So all superhero movies are out.
Yeah, superheroes out. That's all adventure.
I really loved Cinderella Man.
Mm.
That's a really good one by Ron Howard. Mm-hmm. And I... What's another film? I'm realizing now. Adventure's a big crutch for me.
That's okay. That's okay. It's interesting. You know, this is a therapy session, actually.
This is a therapy session.
We're learning a lot about ourselves today, Dan. And, you know, we're going to go home. And what did we learn? What about do you binge
the
watch?
The Truman Show was really good.
Truman Show is an amazing, amazing
really
film. So rewatchable.
Yeah.
I would say it's got to be Carrie's best work.
Eternal really
Sunshine
good.
Was good.
I can't think of anything better.
But Truman Show is just, you know, yeah, fantastic. Do you binge watch anything?
Oh, I don't have time to binge watch anything. The last thing I binge watched was Breaking Bad on VidAngel. So it had the swears and some of the violence out of it.
Was there anything left? I don't remember.
No, there actually is. That one has a lot of really good stuff. I mean, it's just such a tragic tale of basically it's a cautionary tale of the slippery slope and going into an ends justify the means mentality as well as obviously just giving it into pride overall. But so
I feel like you'd be an interesting film critic. A media critic, because you think about these things. You know, a lot of people go to the movies and TV, and they just want to be entertained.
Yeah, that's
right,
not
that's
me.
That's it.
That's my wife, which is great. I think there's a place for that.
Absolutely.
Just the straight escapism. Love her to death for it.
But I love thinking about, you know, what's actually happening and who these characters are and why the director is making these choices. And sometimes struggling with that. Oh, I wish they hadn't made that choice.
Yeah.
I think maybe in my heart, when I was young, my dad had a Super 8 movie camera and the projector, and every now and then he would take the home movies out and pull the projector out, pull the screen up, dim the lights, and thread the film onto the projector, and we'd watch. Yeah. And when I was old enough, he gave me the Super 8, and you'd take your little cartridge, which would hold 3 minutes of film, and it was silent, and I would make little home, you know, we'd make movies.
That's
we'd
awesome.
Create in the basement, you know, and have little characters. In fact, we had the little Star Wars minis, you know, in 1977 when they came out.
Made
little films, had the land speeder, and then you'd set up Darth Vader and try to do stop motion, but really hard. But then to get...
This sounds like the upbringing of a lot of, like, early directors, like even Phil... Vischer, what's his last name? Vischer, the creator of VeggieTales.
Oh, Vischer.
Vischer, yes. Yeah. Phil Vischer. He
The Tomato and Larry the Cucumber.
He has a book called Me, Myself, and Bob where he talks about this at length. It's very similar to your childhood.
I actually, after the film was developed, in order to have the Star Cruiser shooting the TIE Fighters, I scratched the lines on the film.
He talks about doing that stuff.
And
I love that book.
I've always been a bit of, you know, I like creating.
Yeah.
I'm never going to be a, you know, a big director, but video is just fun to do.
Oh, it's so very much fun. And when you think of it in those terms of it really is the ultimate emotional storytelling format, I feel like, because you're connecting more than one sense. Mm. And I get that you can maybe do more compelling story with like VR and all that kind of stuff now, maybe. I'm not as much into that, but I think film is just so incredibly powerful.
Well, and today, the tools at your disposal to create, you know, here I am talking about having a little handheld silent movie camera. I mean, it did color.
You have an entire production company in your pocket. Every one of us has an entire production company in our pockets.
What do you think that's going to do? Do you think that that makes the space for creators that much more crowded, or do you feel like that's going to help the cream rise to the top faster?
I think some of both, that we're going to see some cream rise to the top faster, but it is also, it's going to be very competitive. What's encouraging is that the internet is creating a place for niche audiences. Mm-hmm. That for the underserved to be served with other stories that they wouldn't be able to otherwise, because the barrier to entry is so low. And that is really cool, as opposed to always having to appeal to the masses. And a lot of what's driving that right now is like Netflix and Amazon. Mm-hmm. Because so much of the independent film has gone away from the big studios, because they're going to all the tentpole, the big giant blockbuster stuff, and the reputable brands, mm-hmm. rather than taking chances on new stuff. Right. But a lot of the risk taking is happening with Netflix and Amazon. But I think there's going to be stuff even above and beyond that. I think we're going to be experimenting in some of that area ourselves. But you asked about bingeable shows.
Yeah.
I don't really binge it because I don't have time for it. But the show I'm coming back to the most right now, and I have a bunch of kids, is Gravity Falls. And if you haven't watched this, in which you probably wouldn't because you haven't, it's so many laughs per minute for me. It's a 2D animated show that was on the Disney Channel back in the day.
Okay.
Gravity Falls, it's all about paranormal and like weird stuff happening. In there's these two characters that go to stay with their uncle during summer break, and they have all this weird stuff that happens in this town of Gravity Falls, Oregon, and it is just, it's a hoot. It's a lot of fun.
I'm gonna have to look that one up.
It's on Disney Plus if you have that.
There you go. Dan Harmon, harmonbrothers.com. This guy, and look, there's Ray Edwards. He's right there. He's trying to avoid us, but it's not going to work.
How are you? Come on over.
Thanks, man. Appreciate having you on.
Thank you, Joel. Appreciate it.
Hey, did you enjoy this show? Well, if you did, I'd really appreciate it if you would review me wherever it is that you listen to this podcast. Share and subscribe. Subscriptions are really everything to podcasters. And really appreciate it if you do that. Tell somebody else about the show. And I'll catch you on the next one. Until then, do good stuff.